So we've talked about this notion of, I want to do a measurement. The Born rule is a good way of saying, if I take a orthonormal basis in the Hilbert space, then that gives me a good notion of a measurement. It allows me to calculate probabilities, and I can associate them with sort of completely distinguishable outcomes. There's a real question as to, you know, what basis do I use to describe a given measurement? So, you know, in our simple discussion of a Stern-Gerlach experiment, measuring in the z direction would be described by some measurement projecting into that basis, 0 and 1. And in the x direction, we use these superposition states. These are quite commonly used states, so I'm just putting them up here so that we all have them. So how do we know what basis to use? I mean, we could just talk abstractly and say, well, you know, a basis defines a measurement. In fact, it's a fairly modern usage of the term, but it's now used quite commonly, especially in the field of quantum information and quantum computation, to say measure in this basis. But you wouldn't have heard people say that type of thing 20 years ago, I think. Traditionally, people use the notion of an observable. I want to measure an observable. There's an observable for position. There's an observable for angular momentum in the z direction. There's an observable for energy. Anything I want to measure, I can associate with some observable. We can talk about, in fact, algebras of observables. It's a nice way of sort of saying, what's the different set of observables? I might be able to define a whole bunch of observables, realize there's operators on my Hilbert space, and to figure out what's the relationship between them. So I can think about different observables for angular momentum, and I can also think of rotations that we relate one observable for angular momentum in one direction to the observable for angular momentum in a different direction. And so historically, that's really how this notion of measurement came about, is people thinking about observables as quantum operators. And relationships between them is given by some sort of symmetry of the system or some other transformation property. And then the key thing that relates the two is that we can connect the idea of measuring in a basis with the idea of measuring an observable through just using the eigenbasis of that observable as an operator. So if I give you an observable as an operator on a Hilbert space, and I say, measure this, measure a single quantum system with this observable, what does that mean? Well, I pick the eigenbasis of that observable. That defines the basis where I calculate my Born rule probabilities. And if I want, I can associate the different measurement outcomes with the eigenvalues for that observable. So there's the connection between these two standard notions. So when we say 0, we mean that the spin component, if this was a Stern-Gerlach experiment, the spin component in a z direction is plus 1. And the vector 1 corresponds to that being minus 1. There's a corresponding observable z, which is just the Pauli z matrix, such that z on 0, that's the plus 1 eigenstate, and z on 1, that's the minus 1 eigenstate. So if I said, measure the observable z, what does that mean? It means find the eigenbasis of z. That is the 0, 1 basis. That defines the basis of which I calculate my Born rule probabilities. And then if I want, I can associate the outcomes with plus 1 and minus 1. Those are the eigenvalues of that observable. Okay. Now, I don't really need to associate the outcomes with the eigenvalues. I keep saying I could if I wanted, but that's sort of just an extra addition that you can put on top. The key thing is the Born rule, which calculates the probabilities of the different possible outcomes using the eigenvectors. So the eigenvalues might not actually have any real significance there, though they're a useful label that we can differentiate the different outcomes. Right, and then so just to review some sort of standard use of observables as opposed to measuring in a basis. So if we measure in a basis, we have if we have a qubit and we measure in the basis 0 and 1, then we have these probabilities. If we now, that is saying something about if I take a single quantum system, prepare it in a state psi, and I measure in that basis, what are the probabilities I'm going to get each of the two outcomes? That's a statement about what I expect to get out of just one measurement. Of course, I can also ask if I repeat this experiment many times. And so just to be clear, what that means is I imagine a large number of independent but identical preparations. So every one of those experiments pairs a quantum system described by the same state psi. I've just got that preparation procedure. I don't touch any of the buttons except I keep hitting the go, 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 go button over and over again. And do that measurement in that basis, the same measurement each and every time on those systems. Then I can calculate the average quantity. Now here I can think of the observable Z. I denote using that notation, which is meant to be, on one hand, sort of a nod to expectation values from probabilities, putting those angular brackets around it. It's also meant to reflect that we're thinking about something to do with bras and kets in quantum mechanics. The average value I'm going to get is going to be I'm going to get the plus one outcome with probability p0, and I'm going to get the minus one outcome with probability p1. And I can, you know, a little bit of manipulation shows that that is just going to be given by taking z, the observable, as an operator and looking at its expectation value in the state psi. Okay. So this should all be familiar, I hope, but I'm just trying to get the notation set that we can talk about measurements of a single quantum system, and there it's more natural to think of measuring in a basis and saying what is the probability that I assign to, I'm only going to get one outcome, what's the probability I'm going to assign to it, but I can also take this ensemble picture and talk about things like average values and calculate things that way. And the whole Dirac notation is ultra convenient and sort of being a natural notation for describing this quantum space of states in a Hilbert space, but also as a nod to expectation values and looking at statistical properties of an ensemble of measurements. And that's really how it was devised originally. Everything was thought of ultimately as an ensemble measurement. Back in the 1930s, nobody ever thought that you'd be able to measure one atom or one electron. It didn't even make sense to talk about that. And just quickly, this is probably very familiar to all of you, but if we wanted to quantify uncertainty in a particular outcome, we might use the standard deviation, or the equivalently, the root mean square deviation from the mean. So if we had an observable A, then I would say that the uncertainty in that observable is given by the square root of the expectation value of how A deviates from its mean value, all squared. And just a bit of a note here. First we'll expand that out. That simplifies to A squared minus A all squared. Just a bit of a note on the side that this quantity is the square of the mean value of A, but this is the mean value of the square of A. And I find this actually, it's useful to revisit this no matter how often you've played with these things in quantum mechanics. Okay, so people tell you right from the beginning, you can't think of systems having some position, quantum systems as having some position. But nonetheless, we introduce a position operator, and we use it all the time in calculating things with, for wave functions, and expectation value of position, and so on. So we have that operator, which is often in our mind as sort of a candidate, for what I should think of as the position of the system. And then I'll write down Hamiltonians that look like classical Hamiltonians and involve things like functions of the position. I might write down a harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian that has momentum squared and position squared in it. And I say, okay, why did I put down a position squared in that Hamiltonian? Well, it came from my classical picture where I had Hooke's law, and I looked at the energy of a classical oscillator. It depended on x squared. So I should use that quantum operator x squared now with a little hat on it as this idea of putting in the square of position. But x squared means something very different in quantum mechanics than taking whatever x is, the position of a system. I know I'm not allowed to think of the position of a system as being, some property that exists without me measuring it. But we do that anyway all the time. We sort of think about it that way. X squared is not the square of that quantity. X squared is telling you something about how the position is spread. Okay? It really relates to the uncertainty in that position. It's not telling you directly about what is the position and then just taking the square of that. And that seems kind of weird when you think, well, we use it all the time in a quantum Hamiltonian that's meant to mimic a classical one, right? So we take a classical Hamiltonian that has an x squared and we just write a quantum Hamiltonian with x squared in it. But what we meant by x squared classically is very, very different than what we mean by x squared quantum mechanically. I don't have a really good resolution to this, but it's just one thing to keep in mind every time you write down some operator in quantum mechanics and take it to some power or take some function of it. You're like, what am I doing here? What does this mean? Okay, well, I can talk about its eigenvalues and just taking the function of those, and that sort of makes sense. But always keep this in the back of your head. Come back to this idea that x squared in quantum mechanics is telling you something about the spread of a wave function, which is really a notion that that classical mechanics doesn't capture at all in the way that we normally describe it. There is no such thing that describes the uncertainty of a classical state. If we talked about probability distributions, Liouville distributions in classical mechanics, there'd be a different story, there'd be a different analog, but we wouldn't use position squared to quantify the spread in a probability distribution. Yet we do exactly that in quantum mechanics. Okay, end of rant. It's just a useful thing to keep in mind when we start taking functions like polynomials of quantum operators. Be very careful with what exactly do you mean by that. Okay, so I'm done with this idea of relating observables with measurement and a basis. I hope that's clear. If that's unfamiliar to any of you, then have a look in some of the standard texts on quantum mechanics and catch up on that. Let's try to move forward to a more sophisticated notion of measurement. Now, I had on that very first slide of operational quantum mechanics the idea that we're going to describe preparations by quantum states. We're going to describe measurements by pick a basis and use the Born rule to project into that basis. Then we had transformations as well. I'm going to postpone transformations for another 15 minutes. Let's now already start thinking of generalizing those notions. You might ask, why is it that I picked to describe measurement? Oh, well, I have to pick a basis of independent of distinguishable outcomes, and then I have to look at components in that basis. It didn't seem very well motivated. And it's not. I mean, there's a much more general and natural way to do this. So in general, what we want from a measurement, we want a map that takes quantum states and gives us probabilities. Probabilities for different possible measurement outcomes. So let's start by just defining a very general way of doing this. And just, well, let's try to be completely general and just say, well, what constraints do we have just to make sure that we're getting a map, not just to any sort of real numbers, but to actual probabilities? We're going to define a set of operators, EM. Why operators? Well, I need something that's going to take, that's going to act on quantum states. We'll come back to this notion of linearity later. And I'm going to define those operators as ones that will give me probabilities. Give me probabilities when I look at this expectation value. Okay, in order for those to be probabilities, I need some requirements on what those operators are. So at the moment, I've just said, let them be. I didn't say any operators. I'm imposing some sort of linearity, so they have to be linear operators. But let's come back to that later. But now I want those operators to take quantum states to probabilities as I've given there. How do I ensure that they're probabilities? Well, let's demand a couple of things. Each PM should be non-negative, can be zero, but probabilities are positive numbers or non-negative numbers for any state psi. And what does that demand mean? Well, if we want these to be operators, they better be positive operators. Technically, I just want them to be non-negative operators. So I'm going to write that as EM greater than or equal to 0. What do I mean by this condition for a matrix? Is everyone happy with that? It means that if I look at its eigenvalues, none of them are negative. Okay, I can have zero eigenvalues, but I can't have negative eigenvalues. And that condition ensures that the expectation value VM for any state in the Hilbert space, no matter what I pick, it's going to be a non-negative number. But those don't necessarily guarantee probabilities yet, so we're going to have to demand something else. We're going to demand that the sum over all possible measurement outcomes of the probabilities has to equal 1. For, again, for all quantum states psi. No matter what preparation I have, It should give me a list of the possible measurement outcomes, probabilities for each of them, and they better add up to 1 if I sum over all possibilities. And what does that give me? That says that the sum of these operators has to equal the identity on this d-dimensional space. Okay, so just a bit of notation. That's the identity operator on the Hilbert space, or the vector space. The vector space of states. So this suggests to me that I can pick general measurements to just be a bunch of positive operators that sum up to the identity. That will give me a quite general way of assigning probabilities to quantum states associated with some choice of measurement given by the choice of these operators. So it's another question to say, well, is this most general set allowed? And the answer is yes. We'll see that really in detail once we really look at the set of full quantum operations and quantum noise. But take it as now as a definition, and we're going to posit, we can take it as a postulate that all of these types of operations, these measurements, are allowed. OK, so there's a couple of conditions. So let me write it out explicitly. A set of positive operators EM such that the sum over all EM, EM is the identity on D is a POVM, which is a positive operator valued measure. Let me just clarify where that term comes from, even though it's largely become an anachronism now. A lot of people say POVM without thinking about where the origins came from, but it was originally, well, you can see why it's a positive operator. We can see what that part is. I mean, we have a bunch of positive operators. The idea is that these positive operators are labeled by a set of possible outcomes. I've implied by taking a sum here that those are a discrete number of outcomes. So that's just a discrete finite space of possibilities. And I have a set of positive operators over that discrete space. But I could also imagine a continuous range of possible measurement outcomes. That's what people were originally thinking about when they thought, OK, I'm measuring some sort of current, maybe a photocurrent out of a photodetector or something. If this set M is continuous, then I want to think of there's a space, a continuous space, a manifold of measurement outcomes. And then the corresponding POVM, there's a, for every point in that space, there's going to be some positive operator. And that needs to be a measurable space. I need to be able to do things like integrate over finite regions of it. And so people came up with this notion of a positive operator valued measure on that space that just means for any, I have a maybe continuous set of outcomes, and for any region of that space of outcomes, I can assign a positive operator that's going to give me the probability of finding a measurement associated with that region. So that's a bit of the origin of the term. As with a lot of things in quantum mechanics, the details are only relevant if you really go to infinite dimensional systems, or in this case, to a continuum of measurement outcomes. If we keep all of those things finite and discrete, then it's quite simple, and you don't need to call things POVMs. You could just call them you call them generalized measurements, perhaps. Yeah?
So do projective measurements just fit inside of this as like eigenvalues 1 or something like that?
Yeah, so you can check. That was my last thing for this slide, the little space down at the bottom. You can check a basis M, should say it's the set, forms an orthonormal basis. That was our previous notion of doing a measurement, pick an orthonormal basis. This defines a particular POVM given by positive operators that are projectors onto the vector M. So it's pretty easy to check that these guys are positive. It's apparent. And of course, they sum to the identity. It's just the fact that they are a basis. Yeah?
In this type of measurements, are we like considering also measurements of having a white wall and saying, oh, there's a photon hit the wall, and now another photon hit the wall, now another, but because that's also a measurement, like detecting when something it hits a wall or a detector.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things to what you said. I mean, it's the idea that the labeling measurements maybe by the time in which they occurred and also the point in space. So you can imagine, here's where the idea of really having a measure space on which to define things, I might say, well, I have a range of possibilities for photons hitting a screen at a given space and time. For every point in space and time, I can imagine nothing hits the screen, or yes, a photon does hit the screen, or maybe more than one hits the screen at that time. I can associate positive operators to all of those outcomes, and then I can talk about saying, okay, well, what's the probability that a photon hit this region within this time interval, and work out the probability. So that's the that's exactly the type of thing that this framework was originally developed to describe. The idea that this notion, I mean, it takes a little bit of thinking and a bunch of examples, but the idea that this notion really captures just about anything you can think of in terms of a quantum measurement. We'll see that through a range of examples. The one thing that this formalism doesn't give you, but we'll come to it eventually, is what happens to the system after I measure it. So this is telling you the probability of a measurement outcome, but it doesn't say anything about what happens to the quantum system. Does this wave function collapse? You know, does it get destroyed? It doesn't say anything about that. It is assuming the measurement is the end. And all I'm doing is looking for the readout on my measurement device of what is its classical value. Okay, so let's try an example of a POVM. And it's going to be very much like this. Oh, sorry, question?
So when we're talking about positive operators, so we're immediately limiting ourselves to only diagonalizable.
Yeah, so in finite dimensional quantum mechanics, it's basically a requirement of anything that's going to be associated with an observable is that we can diagonalize things. There's a bunch of subtleties that occur when we talk about infinite dimensional systems in terms of, can I define a spectrum for this thing? That's the basic requirement of almost all of the observables that we use in quantum mechanics that carries over into almost all of these operator things we use in operational quantum mechanics is the existence of a spectrum. I need to do spectral decompositions. If I can do that, then the rest of the machinery comes together. If I can't, it's usually a sign that says, I'm trying to construct a theory that's not very well posed in the first place, and I should check it again and be very careful with what I'm doing. Well, good question. Okay, so let's try this example. Again, returning to this problem of state discrimination, we're going to have the same problem as before. Two non-orthogonal states. Psi naught and psi 1. And what we're going to ask in this case, so we've already seen that we can't have a measurement that discriminates these two states with certainty, that always gives the right answer and never gives the wrong answer. So we tried to figure out in last lecture, what probability, what measurement gives the highest probability of getting the right answer? Let's slightly redefine the problem. Let's say now that we want a distinguishing measurement. We can't perfectly distinguish things. So what's the caveat? What's the catch? That is never wrong. And we just said before that you can't perfectly distinguish two non-orthogonal quantum states, such that you never get the wrong answer. So if we want to demand that we're never wrong, we have to include the possibility that I choose not to answer, that I say, I don't know. OK? That's a perfectly valid response on a exam and a perfectly valid response to unambiguous state discrimination. I want to say that was definitely the state 0, or that was definitely the state 1, or I don't know. So I want the probability that I guess 1 given 0 to equal the probability that I guess 0 given 1. That's the probability of giving the wrong answer to be 0. But it can fail. So how would we describe such a measurement? Well, first of all, you just heard me say, the outcomes of this measurement have three different possibilities. It's definitely 0, it's definitely 1, or fail. I don't know. I give up. So this is a three outcome measurement. So there are three outcomes. I can label them 0, 1, and fail. These are just the values of m. And then you say, wait a minute, I have, OK, well, maybe those quantum states that exist in a large dimensional Hilbert space, but maybe they're just qubit states. Maybe that's just a two-dimensional Hilbert space. How can you have a three-outcome measurement in a two-dimensional Hilbert space? Well, it's fine using our generalized measurement POVM framework. I couldn't do it using the idea of measurement in a basis, because a basis for a qubit can only have two elements. I needed a more general notion of a measurement, even to pose this as a possibility. OK, so we want a POVM labeled by, with three elements, three positive operators, labeled by 0 and 1 and fail. And then what are those conditions that I have? Well, I wanted that the probability of 1 given 0 is equal to 0. So that is going to be, given the state 0, I have a POVM element corresponding to, I guess the outcome is definitely 1. And I never want that to occur. I want a positive operator E1, which says it's definitely the state 1, and it should never click if the state was 0. And similarly, I want the probability of 0 given a state 1 is 0. That is 1. That is this. OK, well, what does it say about those positive operators? I said these things could be in a large dimensional space, but let's imagine that we're just in a qubit. In fact, let's, again, work in that easiest to picture, work back in that real plane spanned by the two such states. For the same reasons as before, I won't prove it, but make sure you think about it. It doesn't help to have a larger dimensional space. It's enough, no matter what space those two vectors live in, to just consider the restriction to the two-dimensional real space spanned by those two vectors. And then that puts some pretty serious constraints on the positive operators E1 and E0 that I can define, because I need positive operators that have no component along the vector corresponding to the other outcome. And if I'm in a two-dimensional space, that means that this guy, he can't have any component, he has to be a positive operator with no component along psi zero. So let's make him something that's proportional to psi zero perp. So what do I mean by psi zero perp? That is the orthogonal state to psi zero. That's not psi one, because psi one's not orthogonal to psi zero. That's a state that is at right angles with psi zero. It doesn't have to be that projector. It can have some coefficient out front. I just need it to be a positive operator. So I just need that C. Well, technically, C could even be zero. I could pick E1 to be the zero operator. That is, but it's not going to be a very interesting solution. Any questions with that? Okay. This condition is sort of equivalent. I need E0 to be proportional to a state that is perpendicular to psi 1 with some constant of proportionality up front. I've only there defined two of my positive operators. Yep.
Why do your operators have to be Hermitian?
Nope.
They don't have to be Hermitian.
They don't have to be Hermitian, no.
They don't have to be Hermitian. I can think of some other operators which satisfy that condition. Like, you can just take a psi zero orthogonal on the right hand and take any wave function on the left hand.
Yeah, okay, good point. So they end up being Hermitian in part because I need...
Isn't the condition that they're positive information in the finite dimension space? The point is that the tensor product some observables with the Hilbert space of the measurement together. So you only the state itself needs to be the one that you tensor product needs to be Hermitian, but then the entire QMM doesn't need to be. But then it's covered by the fact that it's positive, so that's sufficient. But the entire thing doesn't have to be Hermitian.
So if I extend this to a larger,
that's where POVMs come from, right? By not just considering one system, but looking at a system which is coupled to the second system and just only considering the first one.
Yeah, so that's a good point, which we're going to come to in a subsequent lecture, is the idea of how to view generalized measurements as appearing as projective measurements on a larger system. The fact that they have to be projectors on the larger system puts some constraints on what they are on the smaller ones. But I don't see why we have to. I want to say that's enough for me to just derive the fact that they are these Hermitian operators here, just from what I haven't imposed yet is the fact that these guys have to sum to the identity together with the third outcome. And I want to say that if I picked anything other than these two, I wouldn't be able to sum them to the identity.
Also, the reasons why they're generalizations of operators in general is that we don't need to rely on hermeticity anymore.
I do really want to relax the condition of hermeticity, and it. Although it is possible to think of POVMs as coming from measurements on larger systems, and we'll come to that, it's not necessary. You can derive the POVM formalism entirely within sort of a self-consistent requirement, just of I need maps from quantum systems to probabilities satisfying the rules I gave on the previous slide.
But the rules?
Those rules come from somewhere, right? You just consider a composite system and you only look at one part. And then you see, hey, these satisfy these two relations. What if I assume only those two relations? And then you come to this. It doesn't just come dropping out of the sky. Polynomial.
I mean, it's a point of like, you know, what perspective do I want to take? Am I taking an axiomatic approach to constructing what could be the set of possible measurements, or am I trying to derive it from looking at things coupled to larger systems and have a closed theory of quantum mechanics that has only projective measurements? They should be equivalent, but they are distinct approaches. So what I'm arguing is that I should be able to impose on what is a generalized measurement that I just want linear maps from quantum states to probabilities, and that I should impose the condition that they are probabilities, so they have to be positive operators, they have to sum to the identity. I should not have to put in any additional requirements that say that they are derivable from measurements on a larger system.
But also, like the set of rules that you gave before, they would also define just projection operators, and then the difference for POVMs, in the way that it would be different from the projection operators, it would be that the trace of two different one would be not equal to zero, where the projection would be equal to zero, and that's where they differ. So the set of rules in the previous slide would also define projection operators.
I'm sorry, I'm maybe missing the point here, but I'm worried we're getting a bit off topic that whether the rules that we gave on the previous slide are derivable from something else or can be taken as a postulate on a type of measurement is a matter of choice.
What now, she's saying is that you defined BVMs and not BOVMs.
Like both, and like the distinction, like those definitions are also what describe projection valued operators, and then the difference between the POVMs and just the projection values would be of what I get when I trace two different EMs, whether it's the trace would be equal to zero or not, because the POVMs is going to give me information on the off-diagonal elements, so that those definitions would also satisfy just projection valued operators.
So I agree that this definition is satisfied by PVMs, but there is no condition in here that I've defined at the moment that says these need to be PVMs, these need to be projectors. There's no condition in here that says these things need to be Hermitian. Okay? All that we've required is that they're positive operators and that they sum to the identity. That's all you need to be able to define the notion of what is a POVM. Okay? So maybe we can talk about it after, because I'm just missing your point. I'm arguing that this is sufficient to define what is a POVM, and then the question, which I still am struggling with in my mind, is I have not imposed any requirement of these operators being Hermitian. I've only required that they be positive operators. On a two-dimensional space, if we want to enforce both positivity and that these conditions give zero, then the only solution is going to be things that are proportional to these projectors. I feel like I should have a quick and simple proof to show that, and I can't think of one on the spot. But maybe we can take that up after.
Positive operators are necessarily Hermitian.
Positive operators are necessarily Hermitian.
Well, when it's composite with the measurement, but if you just take the EM of the...
EM, if it's a positive operator, it's necessarily Hermitian.
Yeah.
Which you can see just by looking at the diagonal representation.
Yeah, that's a very good point. So if I can just reiterate exactly what you just said, work in the eigenbasis of this positive operator, and it's then apparent in that basis that it is a Hermitian operator. And of course, if it's Hermitian in one basis, it's I mean, hermeticity is a basis-independent operation. So thanks for that.
Okay. So you're saying all POVMs are, like all operators in POVMs are Hermitian?
Not for infinite dimensions.
For finite dimensional quantum systems. So this sounds like a good conversation to have over lunch. The requirement of positivity and this one ensures that they are these Hermitian operators, where we just haven't set what C and D are. Okay, where are we going with this? So we've defined the POVMs up to constant C and D, sorry, the POVM elements for two of the outcomes. We haven't defined the third one yet, but it is implicitly defined by the fact that the three have to sum to the identity on this two-dimensional space. So let's work entirely on this two-dimensional space and just define it this way. Now you sort of say, well, what if it was a larger space and you haven't summed to the identity on that larger space, you've only summed to the identity on this two-dimensional space. Well, then I just fill out this last element with, I can basically make this the identity on the full-dimensional space, and then I'll just subtract off these operators viewed as acting on that larger dimensional space. So they're just still rank one operators. So this two here can be replaced by D, it's basically irrelevant because for measuring those two quantum states, anything on the rest of the space will just never occur.
So, for example, if I consider the zero state for spin on the z direction and the plus in the x direction, mm-hmm. those are not orthogonal because the x has a zero seat. So I can use these, and what we are saying is that the positive operator are just, okay, I measure in the z direction, and if I got a 1, it's that I know that it's there. And I measure in the x direction, the 1, it's there, but if I don't get any of those, I fail.
Yes, so the trick comes in, so we're not quite done yet, is in making sure that we've still satisfied all the requirements of a POVM. So we have these two elements where the restrictions to C and D greater than 0 ensures that they're positive. We've defined this third element, which ensures that they sum to the identity. But we have not yet imposed any condition that this is a positive operator. And we better make it positive, or else we don't have a POVM. So here's the fundamental question that makes it now a problem you have to solve. How large can C and D be and still have E fail be a positive operator? That's what prevents you from having a projective measurement. Okay, so let's think about the case that you just described. The two non-orthogonal states are the zero state and the plus state, which is an equal superposition of 0 plus 1. You might say, okay, well, I want E1 to be opposite the zero state, so it should be the 1 state, and I want E0 to be opposite the plus state, so it should be the minus state. But that doesn't itself form a projective measurement. I need to have a third element, which will be this identity minus something proportional to the 1 state. Oh, I wrote 1 and 2 there. That doesn't make sense. That's 0 and 1. Identity minus something proportional to the minus state and something proportional to the 1 state. How much of the the minus state and the 1 state can I subtract off the identity and still have E fail be a positive operator? Well, there's many ways to do it. I mean, I could pick D equal to 0, and then I can have C equal to 1. And then I'm doing a projective measurement now in the 0, 1 basis. Every time I get 1, I can say, well, then it was definitely not 0, so it was definitely the plus state. But every time I get the 0 outcome, I say fail. I could equally well pick C equal to 0 and D equal to 1, and then I'm measuring in the plus minus basis. And with one of the outcomes, I can say if I got minus, it's definitely not the plus state, so it was the 0 state. But if I get plus, I'm like, oh, fail. But there should be some value of C and D, both non-zero, that gives me something non-trivial. And again, it's like the last problem. You have to say, well, what's my prior distribution on the two states? And then I want to sort of, I want to maximize something or optimize something. I want to say, maybe, what is the smallest I can make the fail outcome probability be, given a uniform distribution over those two states? Yeah. So let me, I just said a lot. Let me try to write down some examples. So for example, if C equals 1 and D equals 0, this would be a projective measurement, meaning a measurement in a basis, E1 equals psi naught perp, psi naught perp. E0 is equal to 0, so it's basically not an outcome. And E fail is projector onto psi 0. But that will give the probability of failure quite often. So the question might be, can I minimize? Minimize. The average probability of getting a fail, which might be the probability of getting a fail given the zero state, and the probability of giving a fail given the one state. I need some prior probability on those, so maybe let's make them equal probability. And then I might try to say, what is the smallest value of C and D? Forget that. What values of C and D minimize this? I have expressions for these using the Born rule for the E fail operator. I can write that out using the states. I can write out expressions that involve C and D, and then I can try to pick the values of C and D that are going to minimize this probability of failure. That turns out to be a convex optimization. That this one you can actually work out by hand. There's a little exercise if you want to see if you can find those best values. And what you'll find is that my POVM includes two elements which look like projectors under quantum states, but they will have, C and D will turn out to be some number less than 1. Both of those numbers will be equal in the optimal solution with this equal prior, and they'll turn out to be something less than 1. So they sort of look like projectors, but they're not projectors because they don't have eigenvalue 1. They have an eigenvalue less than 1. So they're just positive rank 1 projectors. Positive rank 1 operators. And then this guy you'll check will still have full rank. Any questions on that? I'm leaving you guys with some fun to be had if you like your convex optimizations. We won't look at the full solution. So there's an example of a more general type of measurement. It's on a two-dimensional space, but it's got 3 outcomes. And it's now solving a different type of problem in terms of state discrimination. All right. Any other questions? Let's go on to, so we haven't talked about transformation. So I said operational quantum mechanics. We have preparations, transformations, measurements. We already know what the answer is if we have a nice closed system. You've studied this before. In fact, probably most of your quantum mechanics courses focused on this particular aspect. If we have a closed quantum system, meaning we're describing a quantum system that's not interacting with any other quantum systems outside of our description, then we want some linear map, which is going to take quantum states to new quantum states. And if we want to preserve the norm, which is the key defining property of our quantum states, they all have to be normalized in order for probabilities to equal 1, in order for the Born rule to work, then the map we want is a unitary map. So where does unitarity come from? It just comes from if we're considering a closed quantum system that takes quantum states to quantum states. If we want to preserve the norm, we need to have unitarity. Preserve the norm for any quantum state. Okay, so we note that U preserves inner products in general. Not just the norm of a given quantum state, but if I have two quantum states, psi and phi, then their norm after unitary evolution, sorry, their inner product after unitary evolution, psi prime is equal to U of psi. Phi prime is equal to U of phi, then the norm, the inner product of any two quantum states is preserved. So we got the fact that they're unitary operators just from the fact that we wanted to preserve the norms of all the quantum states. But then something that comes along with that is that the angle between any two quantum states is preserved under that unitary evolution. And one consequence of that is that states cannot be made more distinguishable. All of our calculations for both state discrimination and unambiguous state discrimination, where we're trying to figure out whether it's this state or that state, putting in arbitrary unitary evolution is never going to help us, because if they were non-orthogonal with some overlap before, under unitary evolution is going to be the same after. We won't go into the detail, but if for those of you who've heard about the no-cloning theorem and the fact that we can't copy quantum states, it all basically originates from these types of principles. Of course, a more general theory includes more general types of maps rather than just closed unitary evolution, but this is sort of the origin of that no-cloning theorem. Okay, where does U come from? That's really the question of almost all theoretical physics. The answer is dynamics, for the most part. We think of the unitary operation that takes us from some time t1 to some later time t2 is given by a Hamiltonian operator and the time difference. It only depends on the time difference. So that's not a function of t1 minus t2, that's just times. That's the Hamiltonian. It's the energy operator. And then here, because of this definition, the hermeticity of H ensures the unitarity of U. Hmm. which remember came about at the top because it preserves the norm of quantum states. So why do we demand Hamiltonians are Hermitian? Well, because they lead to the Schrodinger equation to evolution, which is unitary, and that has to be unitary because it preserves the norm. So I'm just reiterating this point again and again that almost all of quantum mechanics comes about from the postulate of this linear state space and preserving the norm on that state space. The rules of quantum measurement, the rules of quantum dynamics, are often most simply expressed just in statements about, I need to preserve normalization. I need to preserve the rules of probability theory. Okay, so I don't want to go for the full remaining half hour, but what I do want to do is cover just a bit of, I guess it'll be refresher to almost everyone here, a bit about using Hamiltonians, solving the Schrodinger equation, and some simple evolution that's going to be quite common to the types of things that we look at in this course. So again, I apologize. I'll be maybe 15 or 20 minutes. This should look familiar to most of you, but let's just treat it as an exercise in making sure that we're all on the same page and that we fix the notation, okay? By all means, if you have questions as to what I'm going to fly through, put up your hand. But what we're just going to talk about here is Schrodinger equation, where you get the solution, how we look at it, what does it mean, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so it should look all very familiar. So in quantum mechanics, we have observables represented by Hermitian operators, and the energy operator is the Hamiltonian. It describes a quantum system in the real physicist sense of the word. You know, we talked about in operational quantum mechanics, a system, okay, what specifies the space of preparations, transformations, measurements? Well, the measurements and the transformations are almost entirely fixed by what is your initial space. And that initial space was fixed basically by just telling you the dimension. So there's like no physics in there. It's just a framework in which to put theories. What's actually making a system be, you know, one physical system as opposed to another? We pick the Hamiltonian. That's going to govern the type of transformations in the system. That Hamiltonian may have some parameters in it that we treat as classical, adjustable parameters. It may depend on some electric or magnetic fields. Maybe we're quantizing them. It's depending on some more fundamental constants. Whatever you want to do, you write down a Hamiltonian. That's going to define your quantum system. So describing a quantum system is equivalent to finding a good Hamiltonian. You guys are all theoretical physicists. Your job is finding Hamiltonians for problems of interest. Okay? That's basically what we do. Almost all of theoretical quantum physics is just finding good Hamiltonians, figuring out the structure of that Hamiltonian, figuring out consequences of evolution under that Hamiltonian. Okay, and that Hamiltonian governs how the system changes with time. That's not any different than classical mechanics. In fact, the Schrodinger equation is the most classical part of all of quantum mechanics. It has a completely classical formulation, if you wanted. All of the interesting quantum stuff comes about in measurement. The Schrodinger equation and Hamiltonian time evolution is, in a sense, just like classical. So we're looking at some wave function at t equals 0. It evolves to some wave function at some later time t. How do we do that? We solve for the Schrodinger equation, which says that changes in the quantum state are given by how the Hamiltonian operator acts on that quantum state. So here's the differential equation, of which if t is time, independent, sorry, if Hamiltonian is time independent, then on the previous slide, that's the solution, right? So we'll jump back and forth between two different perspectives on sort of taking a Hamiltonian. The goal is then to find what is that unitary evolution. Or other times, we'll just be talking about unitary transformations, and we take it as given that you've figured out some sort of Hamiltonian that's going to lead to that unitary evolution. OK, so again, you know, just going through things very quickly. The Hamiltonian has energy eigenstates and eigenvalues. Finding that is the problem of finding the spectrum. This is an infinite dimensional quantum system. Spectral properties of a Hamiltonian can be a whole can of worms. If it's a finite dimensional quantum system, that's just a matrix eigenvalue equation. And it's somewhat easier. Okay, so we have energy eigenstates, we have energy eigenvalues, and the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, we call them the energy eigenstates, are a preferred basis for dynamics. Of course, you can work with any basis you want, but as we all know, if you work in the energy eigenbasis of a system, dynamics and a solution to the Schrödinger equation is essentially trivial, right? So let's just remind ourselves of how that goes. I'm wondering, just in the interest of time, I might even skip some of these easier slides. Yeah. OK, so let's just go right to this one. So here's the general framework for how we solve time evolution in quantum mechanics. Step one is find the Hamiltonian operator. And this is all of physics. Hmm. If you say you're doing physics, that's where you're putting your time and energy into. You're trying to find that Hamiltonian. You're trying to figure out what's a good Hamiltonian for describing a system of which maybe you have a good classical description, or it's which has some desirable properties you're going to try to seek in your model. Okay? So everything that's interesting is in that. The next three steps are completely mechanical. Find the eigenstates and eigenvalues, meaning we want to know the spectrum. Again, if it's finite dimensional, it's pretty straightforward. That can be a bit of a mathematical can of worms if it is a infinite dimensional system. That spectrum can have discrete and continuous parts and so on. We know the standard problem. Step three, express the initial quantum state, psi at t equals 0, in the energy eigenbasis. Energy eigenbasis. And remember, that's our preferred basis. And then once we've done that, the solution to the Schrödinger equation is trivial. It's already given. So if psi at t equals 0 is given by some sum over the basis, some components, cn, then this is just going to be some same components, but they just acquire a phase, which depends on the energies and on time. And then you're done. Okay, so I just wanted to put that up there because we will use that repeatedly. Okay, let's look at a very quick example that, I mean, it's almost trivial, but I think it is important for us to just sort of fix that notation. And that's just spin precession. You know, this is a standard way that you might construct a Hamiltonian starting right from the beginning. I'm trying to describe the precession of a spin that has some magnetic moment in the presence of an external classical magnetic field. So classically, we have a potential energy. For that magnetic moment in a external magnetic field, mu dot b. So this is my mu, there's my external field, b. For an electron, for a particle with spin, we have the magnetic moment is related to the spin of the particle, and for an electron, G is about equal to 2. Mass of the electron is m, charge is minus E. That means this whole thing simplifies down to E on me spin dot B. And if we define z hat to be the direction of E, direction of B. So B is B naught Z hat. Then this Hamiltonian is equal to E B naught on ME H bar on 2 times this Pauli Z operator. And so that can be written as some frequency omega naught H bar on 2 times the Z operator. So it's very standard to use this type of Hamiltonian for a qubit system to basically define what is my z direction to be such that the energy basis is the eigenbasis of the z operator. Okay, so for spins, you have spatial direction that makes that sort of straightforward. But any two-dimensional quantum system that I might want to study, whether it's two quantized energy levels in an atom, or two polarization states of a photon, two quantized states of a superconducting device, whatever, I almost always want to choose my bare Hamiltonian to be one that's proportional to choose a basis, such that I can write the Hamiltonian as just proportional to the Pauli sigma z operator. Okay? And then the spectrum is easy. We have two quantum states separated by h bar omega in energy. One's the ground state, one's the excited state. And then time evolution for this type of system is very simple. Let's just jump ahead two slides and write the answer. For the Hamiltonian, given by this, time evolution is given by a quantum state written in its energy eigenbasis evolves as here I should write the initial state. Psi t equals 0 is some general initial state on the Bloch sphere. Time evolution just adds a phase to to the azimuthal component. So the state just processes around the z-axis. The state 0 and 1, the energy eigenstates, are eigenstates of the z operator, Pauli z. They are stationary states. They don't evolve. On the Bloch sphere, quantum states evolve by rotating around this Bloch sphere, acquiring an azimuthal phase linearly with time, but their polar angle does not change. Okay? That picture, I mean, you've probably seen it before, but I just want to emphasize that that picture of picking that Hamiltonian in that basis and working in this frame is so embedded now in the way that most quantum experimentalists think about quantum systems that it's useful in being able to relate occasionally with the experimental literature to have that picture in mind as well, because that's really how most physicists would think about time evolution of a qubit under some constant Hamiltonian. Pick the basis such that it evolves around a Bloch sphere like that. So theta's constant, and phi goes to phi plus omega naught t. That's the Larmor frequency. Maybe just 5 minutes. We'll just breeze through one more aspect of that. When we complicate things a bit by making time-dependent Hamiltonians, so then the solution to the Schrodinger equation becomes trickier. We can't use the general solution. We have to use a bunch of techniques based on the particular time-dependent Hamiltonian at hand. Here's a very standard one where we take that spin precession problem, a magnetic moment of a spin half particle in a magnetic field precessing around, and now we consider adding a time-dependent magnetic field in order to think about doing fast operations to flip that spin. The easiest way to think about adding a field to flip a spin, when if you don't want to add a field that is significant and comparable to its z component that already exists, that's causing that Larmor frequency. The easiest way to think about doing more general operations that change the polar angle of that spin state is to add a time-dependent field that you think of as acting in the rotating frame. So let me write this explicitly. That's a nice physical picture. In a frame that rotates around the z-axis at frequency given by this Larmor frequency omega naught, we apply a magnetic field B1 in the x rotating direction, or equivalently, or the, you know, it could be in the y direction as well, or anywhere in the xy plane rotating with that spin. So that means in the lab frame, we need to apply a time-dependent field. Okay. So the risk of making myself look silly, we have the rotating spin going around. We want to apply a small magnetic field in this direction that's going to cause it to precess around that component. I'll make myself dizzy if I do that anymore. And so we want to have that small constant field in the rotating frame, and that will look like an oscillating field in the lab frame. What's the solution to the Schrodinger equation in this case? Well, let's make this more general by adding a time-dependent field at any frequency. So this could be any frequency. The idea is maybe it's going to be close to omega naught in order to get a good spin flip. We also have another frequency defined by just the magnitude of that oscillating field. So there's three frequencies in this problem. Then the Hamiltonian looks like omega naught h bar on 2z plus omega 1 cos omega t. Here I should put h bar on 2 x plus sine omega naught omega t y. Those are the Pauli x and y's. We get a Hamiltonian that looks like this. And the problem is it's time dependent. So now we're solving this time-dependent Schrödinger equation, but with a time-dependent Hamiltonian. The solution to this is not as nice as in general. I won't go through the details. What you get here, it's pretty easy to see with that Hamiltonian. It's now going to just be a coupled set of differential equations if we work in a standard basis. But it's still just a two equations, right? So you have to solve a pair of coupled differential equations. Here's a key aspect of the solution. If at time t equals 0, we prepare the state in the 0 state, which is at the top, and we're looking now at the probability of flipping, of going from the 0 state to the 1 state, that's going to be the component of the state at some later time t in the 1 direction. Take the mod square of that. What we get is a term that looks like this. Which is a Lorentzian. And nope. That's not very clear. Let me clean that up. So this is an oscillation. So it's an oscillating term with the Lorentzian envelope. I think I have some figures here. Yeah, so there's the Lorentzian envelope. It says, if I pick my frequency to be right on omega naught, then I get the maximum probability of having that spin flip. But of course, it only flips at certain frequencies. You have to spin doing this. If I deviate away from that Lamour frequency, then the probability of that spin flipping is going to drop off. It's going to start not going on a great circle, but going on a bit of an angle. And how does it drop off? It drops off as a Lorentzian with width governed by the magnitude of the oscillating field that we're putting on, which determines omega 1. Okay, so that's determining the maximum probability that it flips, so timing it such that we've gone through exactly half that cycle. Okay, it's time to stop and have some lunch. Let me just tell you what we're going to do tomorrow. I'm basically considering that to be all we're going to talk about in terms of Hamiltonians and time evolution in that review sense. Tomorrow, we're going to go back to our exercise of taking operational quantum mechanics and generalizing things. So we've talked about going from projective measurements to POVMs. We're going to talk about going from quantum states to density operators and the idea of what mixed states are. We're going to talk about composite quantum systems, so we can talk about tensor products and entanglement. And then we'll go through some aspects of quantum teleportation and Bell inequalities and some of those interesting aspects of even out of two qubit systems. That's tomorrow's stuff. I'll see you then.